accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
November 9th, 1989. History is made. The Berlin Wall falls. Years pass. Decades end. A new century is born. In 2021, one wall remains at Revolution Radio. The wall between Studio A, the Wisdom Circle, and Studio B, the Raw Deal. The wall falls. History is made. Wisdom Circle plus Raw Deal equals the event. James Fetzer. David Scorpio. Giuseppe Baffangolo. History is made. And now, the event.
Well, this is Jim Fetzer, who's simply delighted to be back on this special occasion from coping with a health crisis that really laid me flat. I've been out of action for roughly 2 weeks, but nothing could gladden my heart more than to be on today with our special guest and to be joined by Giuseppe Vaffangulo from the Wisdom Circle. Our guest today is a completely brilliant student of JFK, 9/11, a host of other issues. We've collaborated in many instances, including a brilliant photographic portfolio of what happened at the Pentagon. He was a leading electronic troubleshooter for the Navy until he resigned and went to work for Raytheon. He knows a great deal about what's going on from A to Z. Before I introduce him by name, however, let me mention a significant development within the 9/11 truth community that occurred a few days ago. Richard Gage, who had been the chair of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, has resigned. Now, there are those who think that's unfortunate and bad, but I celebrate it as very good news. Richard Gage was leading a limited hangout with architects and engineers where they would only focus on how the event had happened, will not even talk about who was responsible and why, and gave a false accounting of how it was done using nanothermite, where, among other points, he and architects would not even talk about who was responsible and why, in the absence of which a historical framework, none of this amounts to more than technical gobbledygook to most Americans. He focused on Building 7, characterizing it accurately as a controlled demolition, but we'd already learned that from Dan Rather on 9/11. So in my book, Richard Gage disappearing from the scene is a giant step forward, including that he had a battery of those attempting to defend the idea that a plane had actually hit the Pentagon, which is a crucial central issue, because as the American Command and Control Center, if a plane did not actually hit the Pentagon, we know the whole 9/11 scenario is fraudulent. I'm now pleased to bring in Dennis Camino. Join the event, my friend. We're so glad to have you here.
Well, he's unmuted, so we should be hearing him.
Well, given his background in electronics, I would think Dennis would be able to sort this out. So he also has a phone number where he could call into Mitchell. Dennis, you could call into Mitchell and we can hear you that way, even keeping your image up.
Let's see. What did he say in the private chat? Okay. He asks, is my mic working? So, no, it's not, Dennis. Okay, he's going to try the phone then. Mitchell, he's going
to
be...
Very good, very good, very good. Giuseppe, I'm just so delighted to have you back with me on this special occasion.
Yeah, Jim, tell us a little bit about what did you get hit with, a type of flu experience? What happened?
Well, I was very curious, Giuseppe. It began with some chills on a Wednesday. Then I had a repeat on a Friday where I wrapped myself in a blanket. But Saturday morning, I felt very, very weak. I had difficulty getting out of bed. I had a low fever, virtually no cough, but it was very debilitating. During the course of these events, I'd be briefly hospitalized twice, once for 7 hours, once for eight, and avoided the vax. But before I knew it, they'd done the ravage. And no doubt, therefore, I'm one more statistics for the rampant pandemic across the nation, which you and I both know, as we've reported many times, is a complete hoax. In fact, in my opinion, even more monstrous than 9/11. Dennis, do we have you? Mitchell.
Oh, he's calling Dennis now. Yeah, Jim. I mean, I think I still have that shocking graphic. Here we go. There you go, Jim. Essentially, you're describing a flu, right? And this whole it blows my mind. What is COVID?
Telephone number 503-964-57.
He didn't get it. I guess he'll try again. But, you know, it's insane, this whole scamdemic trying to rebrand. Literally, if you look at the screen, the 2019, 2020, 38 million cases of the flu, 2021, 1,822, because now everything's COVID. And so if you take that on face value, then what these Satanists have done is released a gain-of-function bioweapon that's making people sick, to drive people to getting this deadly jab, this experiment on genetic manipulation, which it should be illegal and shouldn't be occurring in any capacity. And yet, man, it is dark times, disturbing times these days.
Mitchell, any luck? Has Dennis reached you or can you reach him?
Well, he tried calling once, and then, I don't know, did you hear that?
I was calling him, he was calling me.
Oh,
now he's with us right now.
All right, how about now?
There he is.
Dennis, we can hear you now. We can hear you now, my friend. We're so pleased to have you here, and you've done such brilliant work. Give us, let's say, start with a Pentagon, because... In my opinion, once you blow apart the Pentagon, you realize the enormity of the hoax.
Well, the Pentagon thing is you realize what took place is that there was no, for the first 8 minutes after the event, there was no wreckage on the lawn. I think she was a Spec 5 or Spec 4 in the Army, took her camera out, took some really good photography outside. It was completely bereft of any airplane wreckage until quite a few minutes later. There was an F-15 Eagle driver that took off from Andrews and circled the Pentagon and examined it from the air, and he noticed that there was no wreckage visible at all any place around the front of the Pentagon or anywhere around the Pentagon. He reported back that there was no wreckage, and then... Of course, you guys probably remember Jamie McIntyre, who at some point during the morning events there just shortly after everything started, he was looking at the Pentagon and reported he saw no wreckage. So there was a number of reasons why Pentagon didn't work until the FBI agents that were on site started to grab wreckage from the front of the Pentagon and take it out and placed it in the lawn. And we have photographs of them, which we published in articles on Veterans Today and other venues that where we did the articles about Pentagon fakery. So it's quite clear that there was no 80 to 100 tons of aircraft wreckage. April Gallup, who was working in the Pentagon that morning with her kid, and was knocked out cold when an explosion occurred, knocking her backwards and hitting her head and knocking her out. She carried her son out through what was supposed to have been the aircraft impact hole, and she didn't encounter any airplane wreckage. She didn't encounter any wiring. She didn't encounter any jet fuel. She didn't encounter pieces of bodies, seats, luggage, overhead bins, any of the interior of a Boeing 757 either. So they got a major problem with the fact that they reused wreckage from an American Airlines crash in December of 1995, where an aircraft, the pilots were tired. They'd been flying for quite a number of hours. They plugged in the wrong navigation fix for the final approach into the airport. And unfortunately for them, there was another fix in the system. By the way, a lot of these fixes are five-letter designators that are alphabet designators that the FAA uses. And they usually have a name that's associated to something in the general vicinity around the airport. And if these pilots were not really familiar with the history there, they probably wouldn't have noted that the name that they plugged in was for a fix that wasn't even co-located. And the system, the FMS system, should have rejected it because it wasn't in the area. But that they didn't have the proper fix, and they started to descend. The unfortunate fact of life is when the ground proximity warning system went off on their aircraft, the one mistake that they made during the recovery and the climb out is that they failed to retract the spoilers, and the spoilers were still deployed. So the sink rate was high, and they slammed into the mountain. I mistakenly had said during my Pentagon presentation, my 9/11 presentation in Vancouver in 2012, that there was only one survivor. That really wasn't true. A couple people survived, I think a total of six. But that wreckage was recovered by an Israeli company that got permission from the carrier to go into the Columbia jungle and recover it. And because Boeing was concerned about the reuse of aircraft wreckage, they were aware of the fact that the Israeli company had gone in there and recovered it. And the assistant United States attorney, a man last name of Cole, who was in the Seattle area, was investigating this. And he was murdered exactly 1 month to the day of 9/11 for investigating the Israeli company having access to this wreckage and recovering it and taking it out. So that's the wreckage, which has been positively identified by a number of aircraft experts that knew how the paint scheme on American Airlines jets had been altered to where the word American in the front of the aircraft was in different locations. And this, I think it was flight 595 that crashed in Buga. Its paint scheme matched the A that was in the rivet line that was found on the lawn at the Pentagon, which was still with a piece of jungle vine that's only indigenous to that particular jungle that's outside Buga. So we've ascertained that the Israelis got permission and recovered this wreckage. They went so far as to send a Mossad assassin who was identified on the scene using a Tokarev pistol that shot the assistant U.S. attorney who was investigating it. Of course, once the United States government realized that the Mossad was involved in killing the Aussa, as we call them, that was investigating this whole thing, they dropped everything because they realized they were dealing with America's best friend, which is ironic. But we know where the wreckage came from, and we know that the United States government to this day won't talk about where they stored it, because the unique thing about aircraft parks is there are things called trailing documents that that follow an aircraft through production. And virtually every major part and component is documented in a file as it's put on the aircraft. Parts from this aircraft that went down in Buga in December of 95 would easily be in documentation that Boeing still had it in its indices, which by now has probably been completely grabbed and scrubbed by the FBI, who obfuscates and covers up all major crimes since the JFK assassination. So we know where the wreckage came from, and we know that there was a huge dearth of, lack of thereof of wreckage from the Buga crash, because obviously it didn't make any sense that they'd bring all 80 tons of it. But they would drop, the smaller pieces and put them there. The ironic thing was that the aircraft engines were not recovered. They were probably left in the jungle because they didn't have plans to bring them. But what this means is that the Israeli government had a plan. They had no constructive reason to go into the jungle in Buga and grab this wreckage of all the different aircraft crashes that had occurred around the world and bring it with permission from the United States government for staging at the Pentagon on 9/11. So we know which aircraft wreckage is used. It wasn't November 644A's wreckage. Who obviously would have different trailing documents that would prove that all the components found at the Pentagon were wrong, they weren't the right parts. But one of the most striking reasons why we know the Pentagon wreckage wasn't even the same genus possibility is that when they planted the flight data recorder at the Pentagon, the one that they used was a digital model, which really didn't come into the production string until several months after 9/11 occurred. In other words, the tape model that was on the airplane that crashed in Buga was a Sunstrand Model 700, and that's what should have been found because the November 644A was in the same production cycle approximately that the airplane that crashed in Buga was, and it wouldn't have had a digital flight data recorder. Would have still been using tape, and that's what they planted. And we can talk about the incongruencies in wrong things with the flight data recorder, the missing aircraft ID and the missing fleet ID number in the preamble, which is always stored within the unit and written to the memory in what's called a PIG, or protected encapsulation. So there's any number of reasons why we know that the plane that crashed there wasn't the one. A plane spotter saw November 644A, the American plane that allegedly was involved, Flight 77, I think in a New York airport, several days after the event, so it was in one piece and intact. So there's a bunch of reasons that we know that they planted the Buga wreckage. They murdered a United States attorney to cover up the investigation into the recovery of the wreckage by Israelis, which, in my opinion, is pretty dank and dark. By the way, there were a number of articles in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer about this investigation, and they've been scrubbed so that you can't even find them anymore, but I downloaded them and kept them. So the family, of course, probably was aware of what their, the son and daughter probably aware of what their dad was working on when he was murdered by the Israeli Mossad agent that came and shot him. Sitting at his computer composing something when he was murdered through a window with a Tokarev that they shot him with, a stock weapon of assassination choice for Israeli Mossad agents, by the way, especially coming from Europe, which is probably where the guy came from. The picture looks exactly like what you would expect a piece of scum from Haifa or from Tel Aviv to look like, or any place in the Ukraine, for that matter, where they garner these guys. But anyway, to cut it short, they reused wreckage from the Buga crash, which on impact didn't really burn violently because a lot of the aircraft fuel was expended in the flight to Colombia. So that's why a lot of the wreckage is bereft of burn marks on it. there's a number of parts that would have been prominent. The engines would have been there because they would have been in the building, by the way. They would have penetrated the Kevlar jacketing probably a number of meters into the building. They didn't show up until several hours later. There's no wing penetration slots where the wings would have gone in. According to a shill and a CIA operator named Michael Rivero, also named as John Wankus, who is one of the alleged victims on the flight, by the way. He has a couple of different names that he goes by, lives in Hawaii. According to him, the plane hit so hard that it demolecularized and turned into subatomic particles from the impact force, which, of course, is so ludicrous that it's insane, because if you've seen any aircraft crashes, there would have been predominantly mostly tail and wing and, you know, large empennage, fuselage portions there, and of course, a plethora of body parts spread all over, including inside the building, and there just wasn't. There are a number of pieces of wreckage, by the way, that were moved around, which is something you never do, even at a site like this, where they took part that was part of the area around the wing route that was intact from the Booger crash, and they moved it from interior by the blowout ring, which you've seen in photography, and then they picked it up and carried it out, put it out in the front lawn, and you know where it moved. And then there's no reason for it to have been moved except for the fact that they wanted to stage it because it was a fairly large piece. But they were missing approximately, I'd say, 79 tons of airplane wreckage. It just wasn't there, and it wouldn't have been demolecularized per Ribeiro's bullshit. And by the way, there would have been bodies all over the place. In other words, there weren't a lot of people in the aircraft, according to the official list, but there was enough to where when April Gallup crawled through the hole where the aircraft entered, there would have been, you know, viscera everywhere, guts, you know, bone. You know, fragments of hands, feet, you know, major limbs. It would have been a charnel house. You would have never possibly forgotten it. And the thing that's most amazing is that jet fuel. Most people are not familiar with Jet A, what it looks like when it comes out of an airplane in a crash. If it's not consumed in a fireball, which it couldn't have possibly all been, because it had a lot of fuel on board, probably 5,400. Gallons on board the aircraft on impact. The issue with the airplane was that jet fuel would have been everywhere. It would have been on the lawn. It would have been on the facade of the building. It would have been on the in the soil inside the building. It would have had such a very powerful you know, jet fuel stench everywhere. Nobody recovered or recalled that they smelled it. The only thing that that was stated is that they smelled what smelled like cordite at the Pentagon crash. We'll talk about what made the hole and stuff if we get into it. But I want to reiterate once again that the Israelis recovered this crash wreckage with obvious permission, and the U.S. government you know, signing off on this months in advance. They didn't just go into the Booga jungle and grab this stuff and hustle it to the United States. It took a lot of preparation to go over, get permission from the government, bring it over here, and then by the time that the people that Boeing got wind of the fact that there may be counterfeit parts being sold, because it's forbidden to reuse crash or wreckage as resaleable parts for any number of reasons, because of the stresses that are involved when aircraft impact the ground or other aircraft. It damages them in ways that may not be apparent. You know, it causes stress cracking if they're intact. It weakens the structure of a lot of metals, and if it's an instrument or anything from any panel that survived, which it wouldn't have, would have been destroyed. It was marketed again as a used part from a flyable aircraft. It probably wouldn't have been something that you'd want to fly in any aircraft with. So there's a good reason for Boeing to be concerned. There's a good reason for the assistant U.S. attorney to be investigating it, because at the time there was a growing and burgeoning problem, predominantly with recovery and reuse of wrecked aircraft parts. So we have a trail that the United States government has fastidiously tried to cover up, just like in 1963 with the JFK murder. In this case, they bent over backwards to cover up the murder of one of their own, which is so reprehensible and disgusting. It's off the scale of disgusting. But they killed an assistant United States attorney in Seattle to cover up Israeli recovery. So anyway, I'm going to turn it over to you guys and let you comment now.
Those were great points, Dennis. Yes, all four of the alleged commercial planes on 9/11 were only about 25% full in the case of 77, which turns out to not have even been in the air that day. Allegedly 64 aboard when they could carry 289. Before I turn this to Giuseppe, let me ask, would it not have been the case that everyone at the Pentagon, everyone present that day knew this was a hoax and a fraud on the American people? Wouldn't they have all known? And by the way, cordite, for those who are unfamiliar, is a common military used explosive.
Well, I thought that Giuseppe was going to jump in there, but apparently not. Anyway, the cordite, if you remember the photography about what they had for the Pentagon, there was a hole in the C-ring that there was a marking around where the hole was, and it was marked blow out, which is pretty amazing that they actually still left that marking there and didn't obliterate it. At least I would have gone over it with a power washer to make sure people couldn't see it in photography. But there's no way in hell that a Boeing 757 would have penetrated that deep. The airplane is basically a frangible aluminum tube. It's not that structurally substantial to go through a Kevlar-reinforced wall, which that section of the Pentagon had been previously reinforced by the by DOD and predominantly evacuated because construction was still ongoing on 9/11. So the claims about the casualties at the Pentagon, I think, are BS because the paucity of the number of people that are sitting here. By the way, the official Navy story, which is obviously floated by the CIA, was that all the financial data about like $2.1 trillion that was missing from Pentagon budget that Rumsfeld talked about was all being kept in naval computers by naval investigators and the section that was destroyed, which is amazingly convenient, isn't it, that the part of the Pentagon that you've chose to hit and you went to the extent of executing more than a 270-degree turn to strike it after you visibly lost it, and we'll talk about that in a bit, lost visual contact with it, which a pilot wouldn't have done, because if you've ever flown into D.C. Coming in from any number of directions, you can't possibly not see the Pentagon on a crystal clear day like that for more than 25 miles from altitude. In other words, it's very distinctive. It sticks out like a sore thumb. Washington Monument is right there for orientation. There's lots of easy-to-spot landmarks where even if you're unfamiliar, you know what the Pentagon looks like. You know what the Washington Monument looks like, for God's sake. You might not see the White House, although you really can. So all kinds of reasons why you shouldn't have lost it, but there's a reason why they lost it, because they weren't flying in the Boeing 757 when they struck the Pentagon. They were flying a Global Hawk, which was going to launch an AGM 65J model Maverick, which just entered the U.S. Navy's inventory in about May of 2001. And it had a depleted uranium warhead on it, which is a very unique item. And it would have been a requisite to pre-test the weapon like this when it enters the inventory. And I think that the Pentagon was configured on purpose, that one wing, specifically to test the capabilities of the AGM-65. In other words, the whole thing was so pre-staged in so many different ways that there were no subsequent plans to reinforce the other sections of the Pentagon, just that section that they intended to hit, which was ultimately predominantly evacuated for the most part with almost nobody in it because it was under construction. So we have a lot of reasons to really smell the rat that they went in there with the intent to test, weapons on 9/11 amongst other agendas that they had, but they took great advantage of it. By the way, the AGM-65 worked great, but when it detonated on the impact with the wall, a lot of the depleted uranium warhead blew back in the blowback area right in front of the Pentagon and created a massive depleted uranium contamination issue, of which Pentagon people that were on site had to be decontaminated from, because it was detected with radiac equipment that was on site. So they started to wash people down and stuff, and then ultimately later, the United States government went in there with a huge amount of aggregate to dump on the ground to cover up the DU signature, because you would have been able to go in there with a meter and find the pieces that were big enough to really let you zero in on them, and then you could recover them. By the way, people have gone in there and taken samples underneath the aggregate that they dumped, because they didn't lay it down 3 feet deep. It's only 5 or 6 inches deep, because they were so cheap they didn't buy enough. But so you can actually get down to where the DU is actually at, because as most people don't understand, granite actually has its own radiation signature, and it masks the signature of depleted uranium enough to where if you were going in there from the top and trying to find the chunks of depleted uranium from the explosion on 9/11, you'd have a hard time doing it unless you dug in or drove probes into the ground to take samples that way. So they took extraordinary measures to cover up the depleted uranium. And by the way, there's only one aircraft, to my knowledge, commercial airplane that uses depleted uranium in any of the surfaces of it, and that's the DC-10 MD-11 transport aircraft, a passenger airplane that is long ago, probably even before 9/11, really kind of ceased to be in vogue. And if there was any depleted uranium, it would have come from anti-flutter weights in the horizontal stabilizer, and there wouldn't have been enough of it for them to drop all that granite to mask the signature of it. So they had to get rid of the signature of depleted uranium, because it was a telltale sign of the use of a militarized warhead to blow the hole in the outer wall, and that's where it's at. So anyway, I'll let you pick it up, Jim.
I think those are all wonderful points, Dennis, and it seems to me to confirm my belief that everyone at the Pentagon at the time knew this was an elaborate fraud. And I wonder what kind of impact that had on morale when so many understood that the American public were being played and the U.S. military was right at the heart of it.
Well, you know, when they went to the hospital to talk to April Gallup when she was recovering from her injuries that day, and U.S. government agents basically told her repetitively over and over again what she was to believe and what she was to say publicly. And she refused to do it. And she's made a number of different interviews since 9/11 where she vehemently cited the fact that they just told over and over again, dictated to her what she was supposed to talk about, what she's supposed to say. And she knew what she didn't see when she crawled through that hole with her son. She didn't see airplane parts, body parts, anything. There would have been miles of wire everywhere inside the point where the plane went through. By the way, if you look at pictures, there's a giant piece of concrete structure hanging down, not swinging down, but still intact right in the hole where the plane apparently penetrated, what they said. There's no way that an airplane traveling at the speed that they said it was, which is impossible for that altitude. They said it was doing 465 knots on impact, which it wasn't. Couldn't possibly achieve that. But if it was doing 465 knots, the hole would have been big enough for the plane to penetrate, and it wasn't. And there would have been no concrete structure hanging down right in the very center of the penetration orifice. So there's a lot of big problems why the story is so ridiculous. But for it to penetrate at that altitude, the engines on the way in would have had to dig trenches. And most people aren't familiar with what ground effect does on an aircraft, but when it's within a half wingspan of the ground, especially an airplane traveling at such ridiculous speed like that, if it was even controllable at all, which it really wouldn't be, but there's no way that the horizontal stabilizer would be able to overcome the outrageous lift vector that would lift it out of ground effect from that speed. In other words, an airplane going fast wants to climb. Unless there's reasons why it can't, but at 465 knots, it would have so much surplus lift that the minuscule, in comparison, horizontal stabilizer wouldn't be able to overcompensate for all that lift, and they wouldn't be able to fly at that low. But the engines, the RB211s that were allegedly on that plane, would have dug trenches on the way to the impact points in the building, which there weren't any, and there were no engines. So there's a number of problems with their whole story, and for it to get down that low, for the profile, it would have it would have probably been impossible to clear the freeway overpass on the way in there without significant issues before it got to the building. And the whole thing doesn't compute, but there's the issue with the story that doesn't work is that we know that the airplane allegedly clipped seven light poles on the way in, and 757, the preponderance of the fuel on board is in the wing structures, and that's where most of it would be, notwithstanding small amount that's not stored in the wings. And if you impact a light pole at 465 knots, which is at 350, it was top speed at that altitude, because of the coefficient of parasite drag, which goes up by the cubed of the velocity. In other words, the faster you go, the more resistance you have because of parasite drag. The aircraft could never have achieved that speed under any circumstances after leveling off from the turn to reacquire the target. But the plane would have exploded. The wings would have hit the poles. There would have been massive explosions and fireballs. Large amounts of jet fuel spewed all over the lawn. The fireballs would have been visible for miles, but the fire that was visible from the Pentagon was dumpster fires, as you well know, because you covered this and put it in stories. But it would have destroyed the wings on the 757 in such a way that it would have left major pieces of the wing long before the building from the light pole strikes. It would have destroyed them. What did strike those poles was the Global Hawk drone that fired the missile, which had the effective wingspan to hit these poles in a way where they didn't have to sidestep back and forth to hit them on purpose. In other words, the Global Hawk had sufficient wingspan to strike those poles. Now, the Global Hawk does not store its fuel in the wing. Predominantly, the fuel storage in Global Hawk is real close to the center line of the aircraft, not in the wing structures. Incidentally, there was a piece of Global Hawk that was shown in a video where, on impact, it flew through the air, landed in the Sheraton DoubleTree parking lot. And on videotape, there's a security guard walks up to it, looks at it after he picks it up, and flings it. And it landed in a woman's car that had her sunroof open, and she didn't discover it till the next morning after she drove home. And then she presumed it was a part of American Airlines Flight 77, which it wasn't. It was part of the leading edge structure of a Global Hawk drone. And we have not only the video of this piece flying through the air back from the Pentagon, but we have a nice, heavy-duty, wonderful, bright-color photograph of it in the museum where they put this Global Hawk part, which shouldn't have been at the Pentagon and not in any way make or form at all, but yet it was. So they have another PR problem here. How do you explain the wreckage of a Global Hawk on 9/11 being picked up by a security guard and flung and presumed to be a part of a 757 when there's absolutely no part of a Boeing 757 that this fiberglass piece would look like? But being very familiar with what these drones look like, how they're constructed, this absolutely comes from a Global Hawk, and it comes from a wing structure approximately outboard enough to where when the impact happened with a light pole, that segment that was found by this woman, Peggy Elgas was her name, when she found it in her car, she didn't realize she had a Global Hawk part. It wasn't a Boeing 757 part.
Dennis, yeah, let me turn it over to Giuseppe for further thoughts. That's all so detailed and convincing. Your thoughts, Giuseppe.
Well, first, it's wonderful to have the legendary Dennis Camino here on the show discussing the facts, because most facts when it comes to 9/11 are ignored because it's mass hypnosis. I mean, laying the groundwork for the mass hypnosis of the scamdemic today. But to me, the Frenchman Thierry Masson, who did the documentary that laid down the picture of what a 757 would look like, and then you saw pictures of when a plane hits a goose and the whole nose collapses, and it includes the ideas that the laws of physics were overwritten that day because a plane could not get that close to the ground, that plane rather. So what do you make of this mass hypnosis, Dennis? Why do so many people believe the obvious bullshit lies?
You know, the thing that is more amazing to me, and it doesn't really shock me as much now 20 years later, but back then when it happened, when I was at Lockheed Martin talking about it with a guy named David Wagner, who we both worked in the test lab there in Eagan, Minnesota. The thing that was so amazing to me is that people could believe that just any weenie who couldn't even rent a Cessna, a light aircraft under 2,500 pounds, Cessna 172, because they weren't confident enough to fly that, could jump into the cockpit, a complex airplane cockpit like this, and fly it with such precision. By the way, on the turn into the Pentagon for the flight data recorder data, the rudder pedals don't budge one inch, not even a centimeter. They're completely static. They're not moving. And even a neophyte had no flying experience at all. In order to maintain what's called perfect coordinated flight with the ball in the center on the slip skid indicator, even an experienced pilot would have had a hard time keeping that ball in the middle, but it was exactly perfectly centered with no rudder inputs whatsoever, which is nonsensical. A pilot would have had to use the rudders, and there was no rudder use whatsoever. That's very striking. There's a bunch of problems with that flight data recorder data, but for anybody that's ever flown anything and tried to pull a high G maneuver, by the way, this would have been approximately a 6G turn in a Boeing 757 at 465 knots, if we believe the ground track that it covered when you look at it and the angle of bank that they would have had to maintain to do this. So they would have had what's called a compressor stall trying to go that fast down low with the airplane, obviously in a position where it would have had to periodically been slipped and skidded sideways on the flight path to keep it flying in a circle to get to the target. And compressor stalls, when they occur, you suddenly lose power and down you go. And airplane engines have a real big problem with air blockage in the inlets that causes compressor stalls. It can happen significantly down low when you're flying like they were that day. And the type of piloting that was apparently evident on this flight track that we saw on 9/11 would have made a lot of commercial airline pilots rather jealous relative to the precision. I don't know any pilot that could have maintained that tight circle to get to the Pentagon with no rudder inputs and keep the ball in the center. It would have been virtually impossible to do it. And controllability issues, aircraft at high speeds like that, are such that aileron control would have been problematic. There would have been any number of reasons why they would have probably started to shed parts once they got beyond 365, 370 on the way into the Pentagon, but no parts came off the airplane at all. There in the flight data recorder data, there was no stick shaker, there was no overspeed. Those are two things that would have been present with the airplane going faster than 350. So here again, there's things that were missing in the data that we have. The flight data recorder also proved that the cockpit door never opened during the so-called hijack time when the plane was hijacked. The interesting thing about airplanes flying at high altitudes at flight level 320 and 330, where this guy was at after it leveled off with the flight crew flying it, is that once it's up there, the speed between stall speed and cruise speed is very close together. We call it coffin corner for a number of different reasons. And any upset with the aircraft puts your airplane in a regime where you're instantly really out of control after the air autopilot disengages. And if you kill a crew member, by the way, by cutting his head off with box cutters, you now have a big problem getting him out of the seat, which with a guy like what they say Burlingame was, he may have even been fictional for all I can tell, a created person that never really existed. To get a guy that large physically out of the seat would require a lot of effort, would have taken significantly more than 3 minutes, and during the struggle to kill him, he would have disengaged the autopilot, which put the airplane in an instant mode of being out of control in such a bad way, by the way, that that neophyte pilots like these guys couldn't rent a Cessna 172 and fly it at an airport. They would have had a really hard time getting it back under control if they even did manage to get it under control. And I've cited this over and over again, that once you stall an airplane at high altitude, there's a number of reasons why you aren't going to really get it going again if the engines quit because the compressor stalls, which is a totally different issue, but could happen because of stall and loss of control at altitude. And the other thing that you have to do is usually you got to get yourself down to a lower altitude, like somewhere below 10,000 feet, to even initiate a restart once the engines are flamed out. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why neophyte pilots wouldn't have been able to carry this out. But the most apparent thing that people, the average layman would never pick up on, is immediately after they got control of the cockpits, they turned instantly on target and went directly to where they were going to hit these buildings. And these guys had already, the plane had already flown hundreds of miles out of the D.C. area and was radar vectored, by air traffic control, where you don't just do a 180-degree turn and go back to where you came from, because that does not work anymore. And the probability that they would have been at least 50 miles off by the time they turned around to get back there is great, because they would have had no knowledge at that level of expertise to reprogram the flight management system to put everything back in so that they could see the target in the flight management system after they turned around, because the plane was programmed to go to California. All the flight nav fixes in the flight path was already programmed for a flight that it was not going to do anymore. It was going back to where it came from. And it would have required maybe 15 minutes of hard work by experienced flight crew members to get the FMS hand programmed in the cockpit so it could go back to DC. An experienced pilot who's flown over PA and all these other places on the way probably would have been able to look out the nose and get himself there pretty good. But a neophyte guy that has no clue what he's doing would have had virtually no chance of getting 50 miles either side of the DC area properly. But yet they turned immediately perfectly on course, which is preposterous and ridiculous. The aircraft never went out of control after the autopilot would have been disengaged. There's a problem with a number of things, like on the way, as you climb up to flight level 180, you set the altimeters with a push button, that sets both altimeters in the cockpit to 29.92 for vertical separation purposes. According to what we have, the flight crew would have done this, but there's no record of it in the flight data recorder data. On the way back down, by the way, as you come down to flight level 180, an experienced crew would have once again set the altimeters, but not to 29.92, but to the barometric field elevation at Washington National, which is approximately where the target was, and this would have been done. So you'd have a good idea where you're at relative to the ground. Now, you'd argue that these guys didn't really care about that kind of precision because they're just going to whack a building, but you definitely would want the transponder to be on so other air traffic would be aware of your altitude as you're tooling along to maintain separation, because you don't want to get hit by another plane on the way in there. And apparently the transponder was allegedly switched off, so this wasn't there. There's other issues with the military. There's a prohibited area there that Mode 4 military transponder replies, which is encrypted. Civilian airliners can't reproduce it and transmit it. Would have been required to get anywhere near that area, and yet the airplane was allowed to proceed and penetrate it, which is absurd. They would have shot it down with their defense systems in the D.C. area, including in the building itself. So the skill level that was allegedly present for this crew, these neophyte hijackers, was exemplary, and there's no way in hell they could have done it. But the average person on the street in America believes that any guy on the street can jump in a cockpit, fly a complex airplane like this with a panel like that, with all glass panel predominantly, and navigate it. That's just ridiculous. But that's the kind of goofy stuff that the average public would believe, and it's completely ridiculous. And one more thing I want to point out is Rusty Amer with Rob Balsamo, who is a pilot for 9/11 Truth Person, who recently died of COVID, by the way, in the last couple months. And I want to mention him, even though I had virtually no use for him. I have to give him some credit for the fact that the pilots for 9/11 Truth proved when you put a guy with a trained cockpit, you know, pilot teaching, showing him how to fly the aircraft, it was virtually impossible for a neophyte to fly the airplane with any modicum of precision that would have been required to hit targets that day, and it was done over and over again. They couldn't do it, and so we have a number of reasons why the story of these Patsies, who really basically were found alive after 9/11, which is pretty good if you can respawn after you've hit buildings and crashed into things. They reported in, and I think it was, it turned out that the main guy involved called his father to tell him that he was still alive the day after 9/11 happened. So I don't understand how Americans can think that a complex airliner cockpit is something that the average weenie can jump into and operate. That's preposterous. And by the way, I can take guys that have flown lesser aircraft and put them in an airplane of that weight class and capability, and they wouldn't be able to probably fly it with any degree of precision either. They're just not used to it. And a lot of people can argue with me, but Jesus Christ Almighty, it's absurd that people can believe the story, but yet they bought it. It's amazing.
Does that have any further thoughts?
Yes, I would like to share the information that Daryl Wayne, who is co-host with the great Rebel Madman Mike Gaddy on Revolution Radio shows Friday noon and Sunday 6 p.m. Eastern, at that time was a commercial airline pilot, a senior pilot for Midwest Airlines, and he was the first pilot to fly over the smoldering rubble and see that it was still molten. And since he was a senior pilot, he also trained people to fly the bigger jets. And so all the Midwest airline pilots couldn't believe the lies. So Daryl Wayne, who's going to be on this Saturday on Scorpio Show, and he can tell the whole story, but I'll make it short. Essentially, Daryl Wayne went in the simulator, which, as listeners may not know, when airlines train pilots, they have a very elaborate simulator that is just like flying a real plane. And the military does the same thing. They're you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment, and it's programmed to rattle you and shake you, and the steering wheel or whatever you call that, it responds or won't respond. It's very real. And so Daryl tried to fly those maneuvers into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, couldn't do it. He had the top pilots attempt that in the simulator. No one, and these are the creme de la creme of commercial pilots at the time, no one could actually do those maneuvers.
Yeah, that's another good point. By the way, like I said, I think, you know, even though the Pentagon speed was ridiculous, the speed of 175 going into the South Tower was also ridiculous. It was like, you know, 512 knots, per what they said, you know, when they did analysis on the speed, which is preposterous. It couldn't do that. But the issue with the airplanes going fast is that you rapidly lose controllability because of airflow changes on the wing surfaces, even though they're swept. To be able to get pretty close to Mach 1, your typical cruise speed for most of these airplanes now is, for fuel efficiency reasons, is underneath 0.81, which is usually what, like, a 727, what I flew years ago, does at altitude. So, being that the jet engines are so different from the JT-8s that were on those aircraft then, these are high bypass turbofans. They're rigged for fuel efficiency. They're very prone to compressor stalling when maneuvering happens in dense air, and the other, you know, issue that we know about clearly on a cold morning like 9/11, below 1,000 feet, which is where you're at, to strike the towers and to hit the Pentagon, you're in cold, dense air suddenly. You're not in, you know, really super cold air, which is very thin up high. You're in really thick, dense air. And a sudden change in the vehicle's yaw, you know, sideways movement through the air mass could compress or stall you in a heartbeat and render you with no power. So there's a number of things that are wrong with it, but the predominant one is the controllability of an airplane 100 knots on the other side of its maximum design limit at that altitude is so preposterously outside the realm of even an advanced pilot's skill range that it makes it problematic to be able to maintain control, especially in a tight turn where the lift and thrust vector has to be offset in a turn. And the load factor increases to where now the stall speed is a factor, even in a tight turn at high speed now, because the lift generation is related. It should be directly up and down with gravity, and now you've offset it by, you know, anywhere between 45 to 90 degrees depending on the bank angle. So there's a lot of problems. For a neophyte to fly it in a 6G environment without being disoriented is preposterous, and that's what we had at the Pentagon. On 9/11, by the way, if you looked at the videos that fed, by the way, they used in the United States, all the video feeds were the same, which is kind of weird. But in Europe, the final trajectory for 175 going into the tower was a downward 30-degree nose-down dive approximately, which is not what we were shown in the United States. We were shown where a plane just pops into the frame and flies straight and level and smacks the tower. And the interesting thing is that the nose of the aircraft, the very first feed, showed the nose coming all the way out the other side and an engine flying out. Well, the engine that they found on the street underneath a scaffold standing bolt upright with a hand dolly next to it and a Dave Clark aviation headset, if you can believe that.
Came unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities. And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs, but there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either, available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
That the Capitol will ever treat us fairly. You are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job? That Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons in the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Welcome back to hour two of the event, the only weekly simulcast on Revolution Radio featuring the Wisdom Circle from Studio A and the Raw Deal, Jim Fetzer's magnificent platform on Studio B. And so, Dennis, there are so many insane lies. This is probably a tough question that weave the fictional narrative of 911. In your mind, what should be the most ridiculous lie that it would have shocked people into understanding that this never happened the way it's reported and purported?
Well, the biggest thing that they put out was that they lost radar contact of Flight 77 out over Ohio, over a mountainous area where there was a 3D air search radar called an FPS 117, which is a 250 nautical mile range radar, which is in service that day. And even if it was in what they call reduced capability mode, it would attract the plane turning around and returning back to DC, and they would have never lost radar contact. But the drama that Leon Mineta had done with the range call outs about the plane coming back and it was Flight 77. They had no way of knowing what it was because there was no re-identification capability. The FAA, if you lose comms, they can give you instructions if you can receive audio and maybe not transmit, but if the pilots would have been listening on the frequency, if it would have been real pilots, not hijackers, they would have been able to maintain control of the aircraft by re-identifying with ATC if they fell off a radar, which it didn't. But the official story is that that this airplane was positively re-ID'd as Flight 77, which is preposterous because it doesn't follow protocols for air traffic control identification of an airplane, even in what's called NORDO, no radio contact with the plane. They didn't do that. And it was allowed to fly all the way back into D.C. without being intercepted and or shot down on the way in, because the prohibited area inside of the D.C. area would have mandated a shoot down with no Mode 4. I don't care if it's an airliner or whatever it was. It would have been brought down because of the high value of the targets that it would have been possibly striking. It would have killed civilians to prevent it from hitting those buildings. They didn't do that. But the other issue is the no interception thing is very problematic in the sense that all the interceptors that were left over, they were pre-positioned in everywhere but the East Coast on purpose in preparation to keep them out of the area for use. But the few that were left were vectored out over the ocean and forced to circle out over the sea off the east coast of the United States, so they couldn't come in and identify, you know, these planes and force them to not hit targets or shoot them down. And they were not allowed to even play that day, which is preposterous. They would have been. But as you might be aware, there was an order that was issued by Dick Cheney to change the protocols for the authority that the aircraft commanders had as interceptors to deal with them. I'm going to sneeze, so excuse me, I had to cover my microphone a little bit. But that doesn't work. The other, you know, the total lack of intercepts on these aircraft is a big thing. But the thing we haven't talked about is the fact that the timing of everything. North American Air Defense Systems had no phone communications out of Cheyenne Mountain on 9/11. Their phone system was inoperative. And for that to occur would have required somebody, you know, from Inkytel, you know, from the Israeli telephone system to shut it off so that nobody in NORAD could communicate, and that's what they did. They weren't able to pick up a telephone and dial out on 9/11. There's, people think that Osama bin decomposing could disable the phone system at NORAD from Tora Bora. They're more delusional than I want to believe them to be, but most Americans are so delusional that they didn't really care about the fact that no intercepts occurred, and they would have occurred. They would have been multiple intercepts. And there's a reason why they couldn't allow these aircraft to be intercepted. And the fundamental reason is that much of what was seen on 9/11 was unprecedented in the sense that false target generation was displayed in the Northeast Air Defense Sector radar scopes, and it would have never been allowed to be displayed to FAA air traffic control personnel because it would have caused massive confusion and potential for mid-air collisions. In other words, air safety is primary. I don't care what they want to do with the drill. The number of different drills, Vigilant, Dildo, or whatever they called it, and all these other, you know, something amalgam and all these other things that they were running on 9/11, they were all you know, in place, and of course the excuse that everybody used is, well, the FAA didn't know what was real and what was not. But what we found through examination with a guy named Blue Collar Republican that I worked with during analysis of the flight data recorder positional data, is that the data was off in position by 26.7 seconds. And of course, the public doesn't really care about this, but there's a big issue with this in the sense that for the radar data to be so skewed in time and not be accurate is not real, because all equipment racks and all DOD facilities use cesium beam ion clock time synchronization. It's all synced up with WWV in the D.C. area. It would have been from the Naval Observatory there, right there locally. But there's no way that there would have been a 26.7-second disparity in positioning. And on 9/11, the reason why they couldn't allow interceptors to be potentially radar vectored to these targets is they would have flown to where the targets were, and there would have been nothing. There would have been no airliner. And the reason why is that much of what was being displayed for 9/11 was recorded on a device called SPH-1 or SPH-2. I worked on this device on the USS Truxton in the 1970s, and it was a radar recorder reproducer that the military had capability of. And they removed one from the USS Truxton. I don't know where it went after it went, but it was designed and built by Johns Hopkins University and allowed the military to pre-record scenarios and replay them on radar systems. And much of what occurred on 9/11 because of the 26.7-second offset was necessary for the offset because they had to mix the radar, live radar targets, back with recorded, pre-recorded video from prior exercise, which, by the way, they flew a year before using a Boeing 757 flying over the Pentagon so low that it rattled a building. But my supposition is that the consistent 26.7-second delay was two FPS-117 radar sweeps, which allow the operators, the Israeli operators, and the E-4Bs over Washington, D.C., over Arlington, and over New York City, two separate E-4Bs, by the way, that were under lease by the Israeli Air Force on 9/11. They were the command and control for 9/11, and they were the ones that had to call out targets that they didn't want to be seen on the radar systems and make it so that people couldn't see them. But interceptor pilots would have flown to where these recorded targets were, they would have seen no planes. And the reason why I know this for a fact is that on 9/11, there was a guy in November 6, 2002, Papa, who was in a Piper Aerostar that was in the airspace with Flight 77. And air traffic control was telling him, you know, your target is like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, you know, X miles. The separation vertically and the distance between these two aircraft, I'm going to tell you from personal experience that there's no way on this planet that the Aerostar pilot would not positively have seen Flight 77 in the sky coming at him the opposite direction. And yet it wasn't there. And air traffic control was calling it out to him, and he was looking for it and couldn't see it. Now, I'm not saying that all pilots have wonderful vision, but on a clear day, ceiling and visibility unlimited, or CAVU that day, it would have been impossible for this pilot not to see it, but yet he did not see it, and he was interviewed by the FBI. He's another important piece of this puzzle. And the reason why I give him mention is that he died in an unfortunate accident not too very long after 9/11 happened, and he had his little interview with the FBI, at which time they found out that he could not, after looking all over the sky, could not see Flight 77, though it was in his airspace and coming right at him. Now, not saying that absolutely cinches it, but the thing that absolutely cinches the use of recorded video being replayed on 9/11 is the 26.7-second delay, which when we talked to the public affairs officer, Andrew, who is a female captain, about how this can be, she had no response to me when I said that there's a cesium beam ion atomic clock feed to every one of your equipment racks at Andrews, just like all military bases. And there's no way that the radar picture could be so skewed in time. It would have to be absolutely on time to negate the problem.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Revolution Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyalty? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what...